This is Digital Story Podcast number 683, April 16th, 2019. Today's theme is What Makes Nikon, Nikon? I'm Derek Story. Nikon is celebrating 60 years of the Nikon F, which was released in 1959 to overcome technical obstacles inherent in the rangefinder design. At the time, the F wasn't designated as a professional camera, but that soon changed, and the events that fueled its evolution are the subject of today's TDS podcast. So anyone who's ever pressed a shutter button and wound the film advance of an analog Nikon camera, and I'm talking about an SLR, knows that they were a marvel of mechanical design. And that's one of the things that always stood out for me with early Nikons, was the attention to detail by the manufacturer in making these cameras. They're amazing. When you hold them in your hand, you press the shutter button, you put your thumb to the film advance lever and push it forward, and just all of those movements and the sounds and the feeling that you get doing it, in addition to focusing the lens, changing the shutter speed, all that good stuff, was all a very tactile experience. And it was very enhancing, in addition to the fact that you would usually come away with a pretty good photograph as well. Now, I wanted to talk about Nikon today because of the 60 years of the Nikon F line. It was a heck of a run that influenced a lot of things in the world of photography, influenced a lot of photographers too. So manufacturers were looking at what Nikon was doing, and photographers were looking as well. And during this period of time, there were a lot of notable events. For me, part of the Nikon mystique is the equipment itself. And that was enhanced further when I started working with analog gear for my film camera shop, the film camera shop that I have on Etsy. And I work with all sorts of different camera brands. I work with Pentax and Olympus and Contax and Yashica. And I really enjoy them all. I mean, cameras from the 1970s and the 1980s in particular are wonderful creatures on the whole. And very seldom do I run into a camera where I just go, don't care for it much. However, the Nikons began to really impress me as I started picking up these cameras for, very cheap, in need of repair. And a lot of times, I'll give you the perfect scenario to illustrate my point. Someone's Nikon would be out in the garage, let's say a Nikon FA, which was a pretty cool camera in itself. And let's say it was Uncle Bob's or great uncle or granddad's camera. It ended up in the garage and it's been there for a couple decades. So, there it is. There, it's just out there, this forgotten Nikon, sitting there covered in layers of fine grime that had settled on it over the years. And it probably endured extreme temperatures as well, both heat and cold. And then one day, let's say recently, somebody discovers it. They're cleaning out the garage or they're thinning out or getting ready to move or, whatever leads to these sort of things. And they see this old Nikon FA, kind of dusty, maybe very grimy, and going, hey, maybe somebody will want this. I'll put it on eBay. I'll put it in an estate sale. I'll do whatever. Now, most of the time on eBay in particular with these cameras, they're rarely serviced before they're sold. In other words, I think most sellers on eBay are working off quantity. So, the stuff comes in and they're just trying to move it. They're just trying to move it along. And as a result, a lot of times when you look at these old cameras, you just go, whoa, woof. And the price is very low. You don't even know if it works or not, right? And it's ugly to boot. What I started discovering with the Nikons, and we'll stick with the FA right now, is that these things would come in and, even I'm going sometimes, oh, gosh, I don't know. And, you know, I'll start cleaning it. I'll put batteries in it to see if the meter works, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. And I'll get the outside cleaned up. And a lot of times I'll be able, if I can drop the focusing screen, I can blow out the finder and, you know, do some of that stuff. Maybe replace the seals in the back, maybe replace the mirror bumper if that's deteriorated. You know, do all that kind of stuff. And then when I get it looking pretty good, then I can kind of enjoy the camera a bit. And that's when I'll really start, you know, taking some pictures with it and winding it and using the self-timer, doing all that stuff. I test that initially, you know, to find out if I should even clean it or not. If it passes that initial test, then I'll clean it. But then I really get to know it afterwards. And I have been amazed time and time again with these Nikons that they have been abused. I can tell they have been abused or ignored or whatever for decades. And once you clean up the outside, the mechanics almost always work wonderfully. I mean, 3 out of 4 times, the mechanics sound great. And the FA is a perfect example because, you know, like the FE and like the, you know, the F2 and all of those, they just have wonderful ball bearing mechanisms for the advanced levers and all that kind of stuff. And it blows me away. And I was thinking, as I'm working on these cameras and getting them, you know, ready for their encore performance in life, I was thinking, you know, of the stuff that we have today. You know, whether it's our smartphones or our cameras, whatever, you know, devices, tools that we're using, how many of them could sit in a garage for 30 years with it snowing outside during the winter and then baking hot in the summer and then, you know, dust and grime and everything, and then power up 30 years later and work as well as they did when they were first exiled to whatever godforsaken place they were exiled to. And I don't know the answer to that question, but my feeling is, my suspicion is, that a lot of the tools we use today could not pass this extreme torture test. And as I started studying Nikon Fs more, the whole F family, both the amateur cameras and the pro cameras, I really started to learn about, you know, Nikon themselves, and you know, I started studying how they made cameras and how a lot of these cameras had a lot of hand making going into them. Yes, there's automation as well, but that it was really a lot of times a hand making experience combined with the automation. In addition to everything else of what makes a Nikon, you know, one of the things that will always jump out to me is just how well made many of these cameras are. So let's get to some of the milestones, though, because those are interesting as well. I mean, it's one thing to wax about their mechanical beauty and functionality. It's another thing to really look at some of the things that happened over the past 60 years. Let's start in 1959 with the introduction of the Nikon F. This was the beginning of this run that they've enjoyed for the past 60 years. And what was going on there is that, you know, Nikon rangefinder cameras were doing well. And, you know, they were very good cameras, very popular. But there were a handful of technical challenges that required a new camera design. And one of the problems that had to be solved was attaching longer telephoto lenses to these bodies. It was very difficult to do on these rangefinders. So part of the reason why the SLR, the Nikon F, came about was so that Nikon could design a camera that could accommodate these bigger lenses. They also needed a large inner diameter on the lens mount to accommodate faster lenses and to reduce vignetting. And they also wanted a total system camera that could accept a variety of interchangeable lenses and accessories. You know, that was the path forward as they saw it. And at the same time, they knew they wanted to include as much automation as possible with these cameras so they could be user-friendly in addition to everything else. And that was a lot of the thinking that was behind the introduction of the F in 1959. Now, also in 1959, and this isn't a coincidence at all, the world's first telephoto zoom lens was introduced by Nikon. And it was called the Otto Nikkor Telephoto Zoom, 8.5 to 25 centimeters, f4 to 4.5. So, you know, they went hand in hand, right? Nikon knew that it needed the F mount. It knew that it needed a different camera body, really, so that it could accommodate, you know, this first telephoto zoom lens. So that was a bang bang in 1959, and those were two very important events. Now we're going to fast forward to 1971, because you know, there things happened obviously between 1959 and 71. However, I want to note that things did not happen as quickly as they do today. You know, if we go 18 months without a camera update, we're starting to wonder, hey, is this company going under? You know, there hasn't been, you know, a Mark II or a Mark III in, you know, in 18 months. Something must be wrong. Well, it wasn't that way in 1960 and 1970. These cameras had much longer runs. The lenses had much longer runs, and the updates were fewer indeed. But there were things that happened between 1959 and 1971. But 1971, to me, is a major milestone for two reasons. First of all, we get the Nikon F2 in 1971. See what I'm saying? 59 for the Nikon F, 71 for the F2, right? And then the second thing that happened was that Nikon started working with NASA. And this was a big deal. NASA commissioned specifically designed space-ready cameras for their Apollo 15 and 17 missions because, you know, quite frankly, they wanted, you know, smaller cameras, you know, that still could provide the resolution that they needed. And, you know, the result was a Nikon Photomic FTN, which was constructed to withstand these extreme environments of space. Now, also at the same time this year, Nikon's releasing the F2, which is an iconic camera. It was reliable. It was easy to use. It had a lot of features, and professional photographers just love this camera, especially newspaper and magazine photographers. So the F2 really got things rolling. The F was definitely a breakthrough camera, but the F2 was a camera that became iconic. And all of that happened in 1971. And then, boom, boom, right after that, 1972, Nikon introduced the world's first extra-low dispersion lens. And, you know, that was the Nikkor H300mm f2.8, was the first lens to use extra-low dispersion glass. And, you know, this is technology that's still widely used today. But, you know, you go back and you look at this lens, again, the 300mm f2.8, they had to solve a number of technical challenges, you know, to design this lens. And they also needed the camera body that, you know, that it could mount to, which leads us back to why the Nikon F came about in the first place. You know, so all these things are just sort of working together, you know, to create this environment that's perfect for photojournalists, for sports photographers, for people that need this type of equipment. Now we're going to move forward again to 1986. And this camera that I'm going to talk about right now is a really interesting camera to me. And this is the Nikon F501, is 1986 camera, and it's the first SLR with built-in autofocus. Now, in North America, the F501 was called the N2020. And I'm fascinated by this camera because right now, today, this camera you can get for under $100 in beautiful shape. For one thing, they just age really well. You know, most of the F501s and and 2020s look fantastic. You know, they're nothing's peeling off. The paint is really good on them. The electronics are solid. And this was a serious camera that had autofocus mechanism built right into the body. I just love it. I mean, it has a built-in motor drive. It has two program modes, or you can go with dual program. As long as you use AIS lenses or autofocus lenses, you can work in program mode. It has all the other exposure modes that you would want. It has focus lock. It has exposure lock. It has this wonderful thing. And, you know, this is a great sort of camera that has its feet in two worlds, because I use it mainly with manual focus lenses. And in the bottom of the viewfinder, as you look through it, you have it's very easy to see two red triangles with a green dot in the middle. And so it has focus assist. So if you're using a manual focus lens, then and let's say that the lens needs to be turned to the left, then you have the arrow on the right pointing to the left, and you turn it until the green dot comes on, and then it's in focus. Same thing if you need to turn it to the right, then you have the arrow on the left side pointing to the right, and you just keep turning it as long as that red arrow is pointing until you get the green dot. So if you're, you know, ever hesitant or going, you don't trust your eyes anymore, and you want a really affordable camera that not only has autofocus but focus assist, you know, the F501 again is, you know, less than $100. Top shutter speed of 1/2000th of a second. By the way, one other thing about this camera, and then I'll move on, is that as it ships, it accepts AAA batteries. So four AAA batteries that go in the bottom. You know, the bottom plate comes off, has a little battery holder. But you can get for cheap, again, an upgrade kit that allows you to use AA batteries in this camera. And it doesn't really extend the height any to do it. It has an adapter kit that basically does away with the bracket that holds the AAA batteries. So you can use either AAA batteries or AA batteries in this camera, which again eliminates the need for, you know, having to worry about the batteries going out of production or anything like that. Really just a fascinating creature to me. So that was 1986. So Nikon introduced the first camera with built-in autofocus, the F501. So those were like the big moments to me that, you know, made the F mount and, you know, this whole experiment really noteworthy. But there's some other fun facts as well. I'll give you a few of them. So the iconic red line that's on Nikon cameras, that made its debut in 1980 with the Nikon F3. So the F3 was the first camera to have the iconic red line. In 1992, they released the Nikonis RS, which was the first underwater SLR with autofocus. In 2004, the company releases the Nikon F6. And, you know, that was the final film installment, you know, 35mm film installment of the Nikon F-series line. And it is a doozy of a camera. If you've ever looked at an F6, they basically have the kitchen sink in there and then more. Just part of the kitchen as well. Every technological advance that they had their hands on, they put in the F6. And even though the F6 marks the end of an era, you know, Nikon obviously does not slow down. Has subsequent milestones, the first camera with Wi-Fi, the first DSLR with video capture. They went back to space with NASA in the International Space Station, on and on and on. And I think that regardless of which camera brand you favor and shoot with, you know, a lot of us shoot with Micro Four Thirds, so we're shooting with Olympus and Panasonic. A lot of Sony shooters in this audience, a lot of Fujifilm shooters in this audience, Canon, of course. But regardless of which of those brands that you favor, you know, chances are very good that Nikon technologies have had some influence on them. And the fact of the matter is, and the reason why I wanted to do this story is that, You know, with this 60-year run with the F mount, it has been good for all of us in photography. And I just really wanted to take a few moments to celebrate this achievement. Just as a footnote, I want to mention that I have excerpts, you know, to put the story together from both the Phoblographer and Nikon rumors. And in the show notes, I did put the links to where I got that information, not only to, you know, honor those two sources, but also so that you could, you know, get more information if you were interested in some of this history. Like I said, I only covered a part of it, but there's a lot more. So I have links both to the pieces on Nikon rumors and the Phoblographer that you may be interested in if you're a Nikon fan. Wedding photographers reveal the red flags that they see at ceremonies that signal a doomed marriage, including no eye contact and poor cake etiquette. And this article I just could not pass up. It was way too fun. This was published on the Daily Mail. The original article was published on the Daily Mail, and then it has been picked up by some other sites as well. But for those of us who have done weddings over the years, and many listening are doing weddings right now, I thought you'd get a kick out of it. And then for the rest of us, you know, even if you've never shot a wedding, you go to weddings, and I think you will find this interesting as well. All right. So here we go. These are pretty good. So a group of wedding photographers have revealed their relationship red flags. They have noticed that ceremonies over the years that ultimately signaled a doomed marriage. So there's a handful of these signals, and I'm going to go over them right now. And of course, the link to the article's in the show notes, so you can read on if you wish. The first one is cake etiquette. And on this one, believe me, this used to stand out at me as well. The couples need to be in sync, regardless of, you know, what they're going to do. You know, sometimes one of them, usually the groom, will force the cake all over the other's face and embarrass and upset them. I've seen this happen a handful of times, and all of those relationships that I have kept up with have ended in divorce. Now, this is a quote from one of the photographers in the article. So, and that was the thing that I always thought too when I was at weddings and photographing weddings, is that, you know, if the groom, and sometimes the bride does it, but if the groom is this like smashing cake all over his bride's face, with her beautiful gown and with her hair and everything, I'm just thinking, that's not good. That's not good. This spells trouble down the road. And apparently a lot of these photographers agreed with my thoughts at that time. So that's the first one. Second one, having a bad fight on the day. And this is what another photographer said. If they are respectful toward one another and toward me, the photographer, during a day full of stress, then I think that's a good indicator of being able to deal with other problems that may arise during a marriage, a woman said. However, a lot of times, you know, they will just descend into this incredibly bad fight during the wedding day. All the photographers felt like that, you know, once that fight gets to a certain level, and they're not stopping it, they don't have the discipline to stop it, then that is a bad sign for, you know, life being married that follows. Okay, so that's the second one, having a bad fight on the day. The third one is when the couple, when they're very quiet or won't talk. Just as overly loud and obnoxious couples can signal trouble, those that barely speak throughout the day are also a concern, so say the photographers. And this is another one that I observed too, that if the groom in particular, but again, the bride, this applies as well, are not talking during the day, they're quiet, you know, that means usually that something's going on upstairs, and usually what's going on upstairs is not good. And a lot of times, you know, that's going to come out, and when that does come out, sometimes it can come out like, ooh, I don't think we should be getting married. Sometimes it's not that severe, but there could be some other problem that could lead to that same issue. So very quiet. Again, that's something to look out for at weddings. The next one is wanting to change a partner. And I thought this anecdote was interesting. One photographer was talking about he was brainstorming with a couple before the wedding on shots that they could do. And the groom really liked cigars and playing poker, you know, that kind of thing. And the groom was, you know, kind of talking about it. And the photographer was going, yeah, we could set up, you know, a shot where, you know, you're with your groomsmen and we're kind of doing this poker game. And the bride-to-be saying, oh, no, he won't be doing any of that anymore. And the photographer's just going, this is not a good sign. And it wasn't. And they were divorced within a year. And, you know, this idea of, you know, changing other people. And I'm not going to wax too philosophical on this, especially after just waxing on the Nikon story. But I will say that, you know, part of being married is letting people be who they are. You know, you want to have common ground, of course. You want to have some compromise, but in the end, you got to let people be who they are or you shouldn't marry them in the first place. And then this last one I found fascinating, which is the omen of getting married outdoors. And a lot of photographers agreed about this. So other professionals chimed in to say that they distrusted any sort of outside venue at all. Just try to be under some sort of cover, whether it be rain or wind. You want some kind of protection from the elements. It could lead to unnecessary fighting on the day, another said. But they all said that outdoor weddings were like the kiss of death. And I'm sure a lot of you listening have been married outdoors and are still married. So I'm not ready to buy into that. Anyway, I thought these were fun, and I have the link in the show notes again. Wedding photographers listening will probably have their own additions. And in fact, if you want to add some, go to our Facebook page where I'm going to post this podcast and add a few of your own. I have a workshops update. I'm going to talk about the Humboldt Redwoods workshop that's coming up September 18th through the 20th. It is going to be our last workshop of the year, and it's going to be a doozy. So we're all sold out on Sonoma Coast, and you know I'm working feverishly on getting ready for those folks. But I've also been doing a lot of work on the Humboldt Redwoods workshop because we have some people on the reserve list right now, and I want to get them as much information as possible so they can plan their trip. So our headquarters is going to be in Fortuna, California, and this is right on the Eel River. It's a great location. And then the other reason why I like it, it's only about a 25-minute drive from the Eureka Airport. And you can fly in from just about anywhere into the Eureka Airport. And then you have just like a 20-25-minute drive to our headquarters. And you're in, you know, a beautiful place while you're doing this drive. It's not like you're driving through downtown LA, right? This is really, really gorgeous country. So I think logistically, I've got a really great place lined up for us. We have a meeting room. We have super affordable accommodations that are very nice. It's going to really help keep the cost down on this. I mean, all of that part is just coming together super well. And then the other part about it, by being in Fortuna, we're just north of all the redwoods, so it's easy to get down to the redwoods. We're on the Eel River. It's going to be easy to do that type of photography as well. And this is just going to be an excellent event to cool off, slow down, and get some great images. Plus, you'll be able to spend some quality time with your fellow Virtual Camera Club members in a very relaxing but photo-rich environment. So I'm really, really liking the way this is shaping up. And I think this is just going to be a great way to end our workshop season. So we still have a few openings on the reserve list for this workshop, and you can secure your seat by visiting thenimblephotographer.com. You just go to thenimblephotographer.com. It'll be the page that comes up. Just click on the Humboldt Redwoods page, and you can put down your fully refundable deposit. It's only $100, and it's fully refundable. And then that secures your seat through the registration process. And then if you decide that you have a conflict or whatever, or if you see the itinerary and go, huh, that's no good, like that's going to happen, right? But anyway, then, of course, the $100 is refundable. Onward and upward. like I said, what a way to end the season. My gosh. A big thanks to all of our Inner Circle members, including our new ones. Yay, welcome aboard. So happy to have you. Our Inner Circle members support this podcast through Patreon. And not only do they help keep the lights on here and keep this show up and running, they also enjoy some special benefits. And we have a nice community developing over there on our Inner Circle site. I really like, you know, hanging out with those folks there. And that has been kind of an unexpected surprise for me, is that, you know, I knew that this community was going to be important for this show, but I did not realize, much in the way that I discovered this with the workshops, how much fun it is to hang out with these people. If you're interested in supporting this show and becoming part of the Inner Circle and enjoying the benefits that come with that, we have a Patreon tile on all the pages of The Digital Story. Just click on it and you can check it out and see for yourself. And finally, a huge thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. They are the folks that supply the printing paper, the envelopes, the glassine sleeves, the ink, the tutorials, the reviews, the blog about photography, and all sorts of other stuff. A Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper to help keep us motivated and inspired and supplied for our home inkjet printing needs. And printing stuff out on paper. You know, one thing I haven't talked about in a while that's very important to me, and it's top of mind because I was doing it the other day, is that if you have a photograph that you really enjoy, that you like a lot, and you really want to see what it's made of, make a print of it. Because it's one thing looking at it on the screen, but it's another thing that when you put it to paper and you have that print hanging around your home or your studio, and you're living with it for a few days, you get to know that image so much better. You'll see things that you'll never see on the screen. I don't know why that is, but it is. And then you could go back and make your final adjustments and really, you know, make it the perfect image that you want it to be. For me, printing is part of that process. I get to know the image in a different way than I do on a computer screen. And as I said, for the images that are really important to me, it's amazing that making an 8x10 or a 13x19 print, how I see things that I just have never seen before in that image. Red River Paper makes it easy for us to do that because they have all the supplies for us. Go over to the site, just click on the tile. It's on all the pages of The Digital Story. You can explore, get some paper, make some prints, and get to know your images as well. All right, that's gonna do it for me today. I have some new camera gear that just came in that I'm gonna be testing. So we're gonna be talking tech here pretty soon. I have a guest that's gonna be coming by the studio this week. That's gonna be fun. So I have an interview coming up. Lots of good stuff in the pipeline. Come back and join us next week. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.